Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. The Paris Agreement on Climate Change has surprising new supporters, by Justin Warland. For years, fossil fuel companies have invested in think tanks and propaganda efforts designed to cast doubt on the science of climate change. But in recent weeks, a number of those same companies and the conservative lawmakers that support them have joined a push to keep President Donald Trump from withdrawing from the historic International Paris Agreement on Climate Change. The turnabout is not the result of newfound appreciation for the science that clearly shows how humans are causing global warming. Instead, U.S. coal interests have come to understand that deep public investment in technology to clean up energy production may be a last hope for the nation's ailing coal industry. Carbon capture and sequestration technology, a key component of what is known in the industry as clean coal, keeps carbon dioxide emitted by coal-fired power plants from entering the atmosphere, reducing its contribution to global warming. But the technology is relatively new and expensive, and will likely remain out of reach without federal incentives and funding for research and development, which the goal of the Paris Agreement could provide. The path forward for clean coal is a world in which we are taking very serious actions to address climate change, says John Coquitt, climate policy director at the Sierra Club. Then resources become available for emissions reductions technology. A bipartisan congressional group has pushed funding for carbon capture research and development, but the efforts have often struggled to gain traction. In theory, more advanced carbon capture technology would allow utilities to continue operating coal-fired power plants while complying with regulations limiting carbon dioxide emissions. That, in turn, could help keep coal companies in business. Under the Paris framework, which was reached in 2015 and took effect in early November, nations including China and the U.S. agreed to keep temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius by 2100. Trump promised repeatedly on the campaign trail to cancel the deal, and while he cannot simply undo a multilateral international agreement, he could begin the years-long process of removing the U.S. and potentially imperil the entire plan. But since taking office, Trump has reconsidered his promise following pressure from some voices in his administration, including his daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who publicly supported action on climate change during his tenure at ExxonMobil, has also encouraged Trump to remain in the deal. Chief among the unlikely supporters of remaining in the Paris Agreement is Cloud Peak Energy, one of America's largest coal producers. Cloud Peak CEO Colin Marshall wrote a letter to Trump saying that the U.S. could shape a more rational climate policy by remaining in the agreement. Arch Coal and Peabody Energy, two major coal companies, also signaled to Trump that they would not protest a decision to remain, according to a Politico report. Without U.S. leadership, the failed international policies that have characterized the past 25 years will continue to predominate, he wrote. Addressing climate concerns need not be a choice between prosperity or environment. U.S. Representative Kevin Cramer, who advised Trump on energy policy during the campaign, has emerged as another supporter of remaining in the deal. The North Dakota Republican is asking his colleagues to support a letter to Trump, making the case that remaining in the Paris Agreement is good for the energy industry. The U.S. should use its seat at the Paris table to defend and promote our commercial interests, including our manufacturing and fossil fuel sector, Cramer says in the letter. We should work closely with our allies to develop, deploy, and commercialize cleaner technologies to help ensure a future for fossil fuels within the context of the global climate agenda. To be sure, this surprising support comes with its own demands. Fossil fuel companies are asking that the U.S. revise the emissions targets set under the Obama administration and stop paying into the United Nations Green Climate Fund. It also prompts a larger question. Why support efforts to reduce emissions at all, no matter the conditions, if you don't believe in climate change in the first place? The answers have resulted in some verbal gymnastics. Take West Virginia Governor Jim Justice, who says he needs more data before he can be certain about climate change, but has spoken to Trump about funding clean coal technology. As we have umpteen more automobiles and more carbon going into the atmosphere, it's surely not going to hurt us to look at ways at extracting carbon, Justice, a billionaire coal mine owner, tells Time. Whether you are a believer in climate change or you're absolutely adamantly not, it's still got to be good for us to look at ways of extracting some carbon. Roger Horton, a former coal miner who founded the advocacy group Citizens for Coal, believes concerns about carbon dioxide emissions are overblown and climate change regulations need to be overturned. But he also supports funding for carbon capture and sequestration research. It's a plain fact that there's 8 billion people and they're exhaling carbon dioxide as well, Horton says. But when it comes to carbon capture technology, he says, if we can do it in a way that's economically viable, then by all means we should do it. Why Republicans Are Nervous About This Kansas Election, by Katie Riley. President Trump became the latest addition Monday to a lineup of high-profile Republican leaders who have waded into a special congressional election taking place in right-leaning Kansas on Tuesday. This is an important election, Trump said on a robocall to tens of thousands of voters in the state. There's really few very much more important, and I need your vote for Ron Estes on Tuesday. The race to fill the House seat left vacant by Mike Pompeo, who left to become Trump's CIA director, has drawn an unusual amount of attention from national party leaders for a race in a traditionally red state. That's because it's seen as the first indicator of how Republicans might fare in future elections. If Democratic candidate Jim Thompson manages to upset Republican Ron Estes or even narrow his margin of victory in this typically red state, some political strategists say it could spell trouble for the GOP. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan recently sent out a fundraising plea to GOP donors, asking them to help strengthen our House majority by supporting Estes. The National Republican Congressional Committee sponsored a TV ad buy against Thompson. Vice President Mike Pence also recorded a robocall for Estes, who was joined by Texas Senator Ted Cruz at a rally in Wichita on Monday. That's the best indicator of any that there's some possibility of an upset, said Burdette Loomis, a political science professor at the University of Kansas who studies elections in the state. He said the push by national party leaders suggests they might have data that foretells a competitive election. There has not been much public polling on the race, which has also not drawn much attention from the Democratic Party at large. Kansas's 4th District is a deep shade of Republican red. GOP lawmakers have held the seat in question for more than two decades. Pompeo won by more than 30 points in November, earning 61% of the vote compared to his Democratic rival's paltry 29.4%. The district also voted for Trump and Romney by comfortable margins in 2016 and 2012, respectively. That's why many strategists say a Democratic upset is still unlikely. It's just still probably a bridge too far for Kansas Democrats, Loomis said, adding that while an outright victory is unlikely, even a decent showing by Thompson would give Democrats enough hope to help drive fundraising in future races. It shouldn't even be close, and it is, and the fact that it is shows that even in the bright red state of Kansas, Trump and Trumpism are not playing particularly well, said Democratic strategist Steve McMahon. These early elections are like a canary in the coal mine. Watch them carefully because there are important lessons to be learned. Several special elections are set to take place in coming months to fill seats left vacant by Trump's cabinet picks. Generating the most attention is a special election in Georgia, where a young Democrat, John Ossoff, has drawn millions in donations, more than any of his opponents. Still, the very fact that these are special elections means they might not be representative of larger political trends. One of the things that makes special elections special is that turnout is hard to predict and that it's not necessarily the same electorate that will show up in the normally scheduled election, said Nathan Gonzalez, editor of Inside Elections, which aims to provide nonpartisan political analysis. Gonzalez pointed to a Pennsylvania special election in May 2010 when Democrats held on to a congressional seat in a district that had not voted for then-President Obama, a result that turned out to be less than prophetic. Months later, Republicans gained 63 seats in the midterm elections and won control of the House. You've got to really be careful about overlearning any lessons from one race in a particular congressional district, Loomis said. The story behind the viral photo of a British woman smiling at a far-right protester by Kate Samuelson. A striking photo of a woman smiling defiantly at the leader of a far-right party during a demonstration in the English city of Birmingham on Saturday has gone viral, with huge numbers of people sharing the image on social media and describing it as a symbol of resistance in the face of racism. The demonstration was organized by the right-wing English Defense League, EDL movement, a protest group that describes the Islamic religion as an authoritarian political doctrine which imposes itself by force. Despite being condemned by a number of leading Birmingham City Council representatives, Saturday's meeting, which attracted around 100 supporters, still went ahead, albeit with a huge police presence. Although the afternoon demonstration began calmly with talks from various EDL members, including its leader, Ian Crossland, scuffles soon began to break out in the crowd. Joe Giddens, a photographer for the UK's Press Association, headed towards a commotion at the back of the square. He heard a girl in a headscarf shouting about notions like Nazis and free speech. She was making her presence known, he told Time over the phone. The mood had changed. About 5 minutes later, Giddens noticed an EDL member, whom he later realized was Crossland, pointing his finger in a woman's face. Before the woman, who has since been identified as Birmingham resident Safia Khan, was led away by police protecting her, Giddens quickly snapped a photo and filed it among his various pictures of the demonstration. In terms of the event, that photo worked well. There was a protester, an EDL member, and a member of the police, Giddens explained. But it wasn't until I properly looked at the body language and the expression on the woman's face that I realized how powerful the photo was. Giddens didn't realize that his photo had gone viral until a colleague tagged him in a tweet sent by Piers Morgan, calling it the photo of the week. That was when I first understood that there was a growing interest in the picture, Giddens said. And then yesterday, it really took off. It's quite bizarre. Sometimes when you take a photo, you know straight away it will be big, and other times you take one thinking there's not much in it and get proved wrong. Although Giddens is hesitant to call the photo career-defining, he told Time that this is by far the most iconic photo he's taken. It's probably the picture I'm most known for now, he said. I think the reason it's made such an impact is because of the body language, he added. Khan looks very calm and collected. She has a smile on her face and her hands are in her pockets. By way of contrast, Crossland looks angry. I wouldn't say he's confronting her and getting up in her face, but when you compare the two, he definitely looks more riled up. I think that's what makes it so special, her expression and the fact that she doesn't look intimidated or scared whatsoever. Uber drivers aren't worried about self-driving cars yet, by Lisa Iadicio. Rachel Bowles, who's been driving for Uber in the Columbus, Ohio area for just over a year, says her job is about much more than getting passengers from A to B. I consider myself part nanny, part chauffeur, she says. A lot of these people just need someone to talk to. That was more true than ever when Bowles picked up a distraught customer coping with the death of his girlfriend's father. Having recently lost her own father, Bowles empathized and offered advice during the trip. It was one of those rides you walk away from feeling really good, she says. But many observers argue that the approximately 4.5 million Americans who work as professional drivers in the U.S. are at risk of being replaced by self-driving vehicles. Once a far-flung fantasy, the technology is inching closer to reality every day. Silicon Valley firms like Uber and Google, as well as automakers like GM and Ford, view driverless cars as the next holy grail of transportation and a potentially lucrative market. Already, self-driving cars are picking up passengers in Pittsburgh and Arizona. Driverless trucks have made deliveries in Colorado, and London is about to deploy autonomous buses. Despite self-driving vehicles' impressive progress, neither Bowles nor any of the half-dozen other rideshare drivers Time interviewed expressed fear of losing their job to a robotic car anytime soon. Some envision themselves working in a different field by the time self-driving technology is ready for prime time, which will likely take several years at least. Workers, after all, tend to be short-term thinkers. Others believe that tech may complement but not completely replace human drivers. There's a lot more to driving than not running into another car, said Kat Ellery, who also drives for Uber and Lyft in Columbus. There are a lot of idiosyncrasies that self-driving cars can't account for. Such sentiment may seem like denying the inevitable, but self-driving vehicles indeed have their limitations. Bad weather, for instance, remains a roadblock. That means they might be fine in sunny San Diego, but less useful in snowy Buffalo. Some drivers, meanwhile, argue they're better than computers at knowing which routes to avoid at certain times or which side roads to take when the highways are clogged up. Daniel Wormer, a longtime Uber driver in Connecticut, argues that his GPS still doesn't always immediately reflect changes in road conditions, like when a new divider appears overnight. An autonomous vehicle, if it's not updated and doesn't have that proper knowledge, could still drive right into a barrier, he says. A fleet of networked self-driving cars could potentially learn from one another, passing data about new road conditions from one vehicle to the next. However, you would still need that first car to be able to handle an unanticipated circumstance. But adaptability remains a weak point for computers, says Professor John Leonard of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Department of Mechanical Engineering. The capacity for human intelligence to deal with the unexpected and to use what we call common sense knowledge to handle situations for which they weren't trained, those things are hard for a robot to do. Some Uber drivers also argue they play the role of babysitter by making sure their passengers aren't mistreating their vehicle. If you're spilling coffee, a driver might say, you can't eat in here, says Julian Jackson, who also drives for Uber in Columbus. If you realize that someone is watching, then you might end up being a little more respectful of other people's things. Ultimately, the biggest factor holding back self-driving cars may not be technology, but passengers. There are a lot of people out there who wouldn't trust a self-driving car, says Carl Johnson, an Uber driver in Kansas City, Missouri. That's true no matter how many studies show autonomous cars are more capable than human drivers. One report from McKinsey & Company estimated that driverless cars could reduce automotive accidents by 90%. Of course, that sentiment may change as self-driving cars become a more typical element of everyday life. Despite these drivers' confidence, it may not be wise for a young person today to bank on a lifelong rideshare career tomorrow. Uber executives in particular have not been shy about their pursuit of self-driving cars, which don't clamor for higher fares or attempt to unionize. So far, the company has tested its autonomous vehicles in Pittsburgh, Tempe, Arizona, and its hometown of San Francisco. Rival Lyft says it plans to deploy autonomous cars around 2021 or 2022. But Uber's self-driving progress hasn't come without setbacks. A recent crash in Arizona, clashes with state regulators, and an ongoing and increasingly nasty legal battle with Google parent company Alphabet have all highlighted just how far it and other companies have to go before robots are zipping us around town. Regardless of how drivers might feel, it's increasingly likely that autonomous cars will make up some portion of tomorrow's transportation landscape. But that world is far enough away that most professional drivers aren't feeling the heat yet. Some, like Johnson, are even ready to embrace such a future. "I think it's a great idea," he says. "I seriously believe there will be one day when we're going to be like the Jetsons." Airstrikes don't mean Trump is suddenly compassionate or strategic. By Elise Jordan. Elise Jordan is an NBC News MSNBC political analyst. She has worked for the Department of State and the National Security Council. It might be naive to feel surprised by the bipartisan cheering of President Donald Trump's quick decision to lob 59 Tomahawk missiles into Syria. But why is it strange to expect the commander-in-chief to invest a shred of thought and planning into the decision to launch a bunch of bombs? Would congressional approval have been too much to ask? Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad's use of chemical weapons should provoke strong emotions, which is exactly why military action by the most capricious American president in history should be debated and approved by Congress. Otherwise, expect Trump's a la carte foreign policy to yield a la carte stability. Our president loves a tweetable victory. Trump's first war follows the pattern of crony capitalistic micromanagement of American industry, just like those 730 jobs at a Carrier furnace factory in Indiana he proudly trumpeted that he saved. Though good for 730 people and their families in the near term, Trump's solution in Indiana is just a band-aid for a problem that needs a tourniquet. Artificial intelligence threatens to eliminate millions of jobs over the next two decades. Now, Trump's action in Syria is the foreign policy equivalent of his "look at all the jobs I saved" tweets, a superficial victory that's tactically meaningless. Eisenhower famously said that plans are nothing, but planning is everything. Though policymakers deserve flexibility when implementing a strategy, Trump has neither plan nor strategy in Syria. He chose from the military's pre-fee selection because his mood changed after he saw horrific images of gassed children on television. "My attitude toward Syria and Assad has changed very much," Trump said, revealing his evident ignorance of years of slaughter and ongoing toxic attacks in the ongoing conflict that has killed tens of thousands of children. "That crosses many, many lines beyond a red line, many, many lines." Because of his undisciplined rhetoric, Trump committed himself to multi-million-dollar action to avoid his predecessor's notoriously hollow red-line threat. Despite UN Ambassador Nikki Haley's bluster that this is not a soft power administration, Trump chose cruise missiles, a primarily soft-target weapon. Cruise missiles simply won't cut it if the goal is to cause lasting destruction. A real campaign requires penetrating missiles to take out command and control centers, radar sites, and all logistics. Clearly sensitive about his impotent strikes, Trump tweeted on Saturday that the strikes weren't supposed to take out the runways. So what was the point exactly? For all of Trump's posturing about his belief in the element of surprise, the timeline dispels any notion of imminent threat requiring hasty action. To prevent a bigger conflict, the Russians were forewarned, which means they in turn forewarned the Syrian allies with whom they share the airbase. Tactically meaningless and strategically flailing. And yet, pundits on both sides praised Trump. When pundits and the bipartisan political class praise an isolated strike with no clear tactical or strategic value, they become part of the problem. Never mind that Trump was holding hands with the Egyptian dictator 2 days prior. A casual bombing campaign meant that Trump suddenly has a heart. Never mind that Trump showed concern for his friend Bill O'Reilly having to pony up millions after multiple women accused O'Reilly of sexual harassment. Launching missiles makes Trump a serious person. We live in a rare, scary time when television commentators occupy a unique vantage point of influence over a president whose hunger for praise is matched only by his superhuman appetite for cable news. Trump specifically queried Sean Spicer about the reception of the airstrikes from Congress and foreign leaders, Spicer noted in a timeline provided to reporters, adding, "There was fairly unanimous praise for the decision and the action the president took." By cheerleading Trump's impulsivity, pundits provided the president with the incentive to continue to shoot first and not even bother to ask questions later. Without a grand strategy, Trump confuses our allies and adversaries alike and makes it virtually impossible to harness the vast power of America's diplomatic, military, and economic might. If everyone's confused amidst the constant chaos, that's weakness, not greatness. There may be a moral case for intervention in Syria, but until a few days ago, Trump had spent years arguing against it. Unless he can explain why his about-face serves the interests of the American public, he and we should stay out. Most doctors' breast cancer advice may be out of date, by Alice Park. Who needs a mammogram and when? These are questions that have vexed women for years now as science and the recommendations it informs has shifted. In 2009, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the USPSTF, advised that most women should start getting regular mammograms at age 50 rather than at age 40, prompting some groups to change their official guidelines, even as others kept their advice the same. Today, confusion persists, and women may not be getting much clarity at the doctor's office either. In a new study published in JAMA Internal Medicine, researchers found that 81% of the doctors recommended mammography to women aged 40 to 44, and 88% recommended it to women aged 45 to 49 years, advice that goes against the latest federal recommendations. Dr. Archana Radhakrishnan, clinical research fellow in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins University, and her colleagues analyzed data from 2,000 doctors in the Breast Cancer Social Network Study, a national survey of primary care, internal medicine, and family medicine physicians and gynecologists. They found that gynecologists were more likely than other physicians to recommend screening for women in their 40s. Their professional physicians organization is one that continues advising women to get screened starting in their 40s. Ironically, 23% said they trusted the USPSTF guidelines more than other breast cancer screening recommendations. Doctors reported trusting a particular guideline, but then recommended screening more frequently than the guideline, says Radhakrishnan. What that highlights is that we still have a ways to go to understand what challenges doctors are facing when they implement clinical guidelines into practice. Those factors may include things like malpractice fears if they don't recommend screening and breast cancer is missed, she says. The disconnect may also reflect a bigger challenge in dismantling a long-standing conventional wisdom, even when such a change is supported by science. For decades, the response to cancer was that more is better. More screening means more cancer can be detected and therefore treated earlier. But recent reviews of the study show that with breast cancer, more screening does not, in fact, save lives. What's more, doctors and patients also have to weigh the risks of false positives, the harms that can come with over-treatment, not to mention the psychological stress and anxiety of a positive mammogram. Understanding that not all cancer needs to be treated immediately, but that some cancers can be monitored until they need treatment, is another major change that not all doctors are comfortable with yet. The findings point out that while the recommendations about breast cancer screening continue to evolve, so too do doctors' and patients' decisions about screening. For now, most health groups are leaning toward a more personalized approach, encouraging a discussion between women and their doctors about how much screening is right for them. Majority of voters want President Trump to release his tax returns. By Jennifer Kalfas. The majority of American voters still want President Donald Trump to release his tax returns, but less so than before he was elected. A new Bloomberg Morning Consult poll found 53% of voters say Trump should be forced to release his tax returns, and 51% say Trump's taxes are either very or somewhat important to them. Additionally, 45% say Trump's taxes are relevant to his job in the White House. The poll surveyed 2,353 registered voters over a two-day period in early April. Before the 2016 presidential election, 62% of voters said it was either very or somewhat important that the candidates release their tax returns, according to a Monmouth University poll. The new data from the poll comes just days before protesters plan to march to demand Trump release his tax returns on April 15th, which is historically when tax day falls, although it's been extended until April 18th this year. Trump broke decades of precedent by refusing to release his tax returns while he was a presidential candidate. In fact, Trump maintains that no one, aside from reporters, cares about his tax returns. "I don't think they care at all," Trump said of Americans' thoughts on his tax returns at a press conference ahead of his inauguration. "The only one that cares about my tax returns are the reporters." But at least 24 states have introduced bills that would require Trump and all other future presidential candidates to release their tax returns in order to be listed on the state's 2020 ballots. And at least 1 million people have signed a petition on the White House's website to demand Trump immediately release his tax returns.
If you've got a sweet tooth, you're going to love Armand Lou. He's the author of Clean Sweets, Simple High-Protein Desserts for One, $22, Amazon.com. A collection of decadent treats packed with nutrients and made with ingredients you likely already have in your kitchen. And because Lou himself is all too familiar with the siren call of sweets, he's designed each recipe to make just one or two satisfying servings, so you won't be tempted to reach for more. Here are three of our favorites, including banana cheesecake breakfast pudding, chocolate Greek yogurt pancakes, and raspberry mousse with a coconut flour crust. Banana cheesecake breakfast pudding serves one. 1 cup full-fat cottage cheese, dairy-free if necessary. 1 medium banana, frozen. 1/2 cup of milk of choice. 1/2 teaspoon vanilla extract. 1 to 2 tablespoons of maple syrup. 1 tablespoon coconut flour, or gluten-free rolled oats, optional. 1. In a high-speed blender, combine all the ingredients until a thick pudding texture remains. Transfer the mixture to a bowl and enjoy. 2. For a very thick pudding, add coconut flour or rolled oats to the blender. For an even thicker pudding, refrigerate the mixture for 30 minutes or so. Chocolate Greek yogurt pancakes serves 1. For the pancakes, 1/2 cup gluten-free oat flour, can substitute with whole wheat, all-purpose, or white flour. 1 teaspoon baking soda. 1/4 teaspoon sea salt. 1 tablespoon cocoa powder. 1 large egg. 3/4 cup vanilla Greek yogurt, dairy-free if necessary. 1/4 teaspoon vanilla extract. For the Greek yogurt chocolate sauce, 2 tablespoons Greek yogurt, 1 tablespoon cocoa powder, 1 tablespoon pure maple syrup, milk of choice as needed. 1. In a mixing bowl, add the oat flour, baking soda, sea salt, and cocoa powder and mix well. 2. In a separate bowl, whisk the egg, Greek yogurt, and vanilla extract until well combined. Pour the wet mixture into the dry mixture and stir until fully combined. The batter should be very thick. 3. Heat a lightly greased frying pan on medium heat. Once the pan is hot, spoon the batter onto it, making pancake shapes. When the edges start to bubble, flip the pancakes and cook until both sides are lightly golden. Once all the pancakes are cooked, in a bowl, make the chocolate sauce by combining the yogurt, cocoa butter, and pure maple syrup and mixing well until fully combined. If the sauce is too thick, add a dash of milk. Layer the pancakes with the frosting and enjoy. Raspberry mousse with coconut flour crust serves one. For the crust, 1 tablespoon coconut flour, 1 tablespoon almond flour, 1 tablespoon nut butter of choice, 1 tablespoon pure maple syrup. Milk is needed, dairy-free if necessary. For the raspberry mousse, 1/2 cup of plain yogurt, 1/2 cup full-fat cottage cheese, dairy-free if necessary, 1/4 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1 to 2 tablespoons coconut palm sugar, 2 tablespoon raspberries divided, and 1 tablespoon coconut flour. 1. In a small bowl, add all the crust ingredients except for the milk. Mix until a crumbly texture remains. Slowly add your milk of choice until a thick batter is formed. Transfer the batter to a cereal bowl or tall glass and set aside. 2. In a blender, add all the mousse ingredients and blend until fully immersed and smooth. Pour the blended mixture into the cereal bowl or glass and top with the rest of the raspberries and enjoy.
Should overbooking flights be illegal? By Nate Hopper. Videos of several law enforcement officers dragging a man off a United Airlines flight departing Chicago's O'Hare Airport for Louisville shocked the internet on Monday. The incident was a rare result of a common practice known as overbooking, in which airlines sell too many tickets, assuming people will either miss or not show up for a flight, or enough customers will volunteer to be compensated handsomely to depart later. Normally, this transaction is completed before passengers enter the plane, but for reasons still unclear, United allowed people to board before realizing it needed to make room for 4 members of its staff. After making several offers to the seated customers but receiving no volunteers, airline staff then proceeded to the last action they can, involuntarily denied boarding. According to the Department of Transportation's laws, airlines have the right to do this, as long as they pay the displaced customer for their troubles, up to a maximum of $1,350. Yet, this also typically happens before the plane is boarded. The entire situation, airlines selling more tickets than they have seats, then having a ticket holder dragged off a plane for refusing to vacate a space he seemed to have paid for, struck many people as strange, especially if it was all legal. Time spoke with Charles Leocha, chairman and co-founder of the consumer advocacy group Travelers United and a member of the Department of Transportation's Advisory Committee for Aviation Consumer Protections. Time. Should overbooking be illegal? Charles Leocha. If overbooking is made illegal, ticket prices are going to go up. The airlines normally do a pretty good job on overbooking. People know it's coming, and they are willing to allow themselves to be bribed to get off the flight. People who are actually bumped and are really irritated about it are almost non-existent. It's a tiny percentage. But the people who want lower prices are around 100%. So, we're all the beneficiaries, except in relatively rare scenarios? Exactly. This whole situation has really nothing to do with overbooking. This situation has to do with a total mismanagement by the airlines. For them to have a whole plane loaded and then to realize they had to move 4 employees, that's just ridiculous. They had to know that 15 minutes earlier, before they finished boarding the plane. Then they could have dealt with it like they ordinarily would have. The relevant Department of Transportation law says that people can be denied boarding. Can a person legally be forcibly removed after boarding the plane? I've never seen a situation like this before in my life. But because all the rules with airlines are written with so many loopholes and caveats, I think no one in the airline is going to jail, even though this guy got beaten up and knocked all over the place and dragged down the aisle. Are passengers legally obligated to obey airline staff once they exit the airport and get on the plane? Before you get onto the flight, you're in the general world. But airlines have control over their planes just like a captain in the old days has control over his ship. They are the ultimate authority. If you don't obey a crew member, then you can be removed or punished. However, if they violate regulations or violate the contract of carriage, then the airline is liable, and the airline has to deal with federal laws. That's why DOT is so important. They're the judge and the jury, and they have not been holding airlines' feet to the fire. I called them and asked if what happened was legal. They said they have to look at it more. Many people are under the impression that when they buy an airline ticket, they are purchasing a seat on the plane. What are people actually paying for? They're paying for transportation from point A to point B, and the way that the airline contracts of carriage are written, they're not even paying for transportation to get them there at the right time, or the same day. They're just getting the best efforts of the airlines. The airlines don't want a lot of people sitting at the airport. That doesn't serve good business purpose. But in the contract, you're really just buying transportation from point A to point B. What should United have done instead? The only reason this happened is because of the airline's incompetence. First, in not being able to manage its own staff. And next, whomever made the decision to send the police on board to forcibly take people off had a lot of different options. They could have put their own people on a different flight. They could have sent a couple of crew members across town to the other Chicago airport. They could have put the crew on a Southwest flight. And if they had offered passengers $1,350 in cash, I bet they would have had 10 people jump up and take it. And there would have been people who would have rented a car and drove down to Louisville. There were a lot of things the airline could have done, but they didn't.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.